beginning to spend the day exploring the what are called the Brahmaviharas, but particularly I am more interested in exploring these cultivations, these pathways, these qualities as insight practices. And yesterday, speaking about metta or boundless, immeasurable friendliness, really speaking about how, in terms of insight and in terms of liberation of the heart, that the primary work or the primary transformative effect of metta, of course, is to release the mind from the patterns of aversion, patterns of aversion, and it's all its forms that can indeed create so much suffering and torment. Speaking yesterday about compassion, and of course to really speak about compassion is to speak about the very tender area of suffering, difficult adversity that we can spend a lot of our lives avoiding or trying to avoid. And so to really cultivate compassion requires of us the willingness to turn towards the suffering, the torment, the struggle that exists in life, and to explore the reactions that we have to the difficult, and to cultivate pathways of other responses rather than fear or resistance or avoidance. So this morning I want to begin by speaking about this third Brahmavihara, which in Pali is mudita, probably more accurately translates as altruistic joy. But I think to understand mudita, I personally find it quite helpful to look at the way in which joy is spoken of in much wider ways in this teaching and in this path. Because altruistic joy is only one sliver of the fabric of joy. And I think for my own experience is that for altruistic joy to arise, we actually need to really explore the place that joy occupies in our lives and in our path, if it occupies any place at all. And the ways in which it plays such an important role. It's a curious thing, this quality of joy, because when you first look, I mean, I'm sure many of you have been on retreats. And, you know, at first glance, they don't look that joyful. they look terribly serious. And it is curious that I find it's actually often quite, it's not only a Western thing. You do actually see this in some Theravadan countries, where this kind of gravitas or this seriousness is almost considered to be almost the only way to practice. You go somewhere like Sri Lanka, for example, and, you know, you'll see people doing walking meditation, and they have a great smile on their face, and they're obviously really enjoying it. They're very visibly enjoying it. Whereas I sometimes think we maybe have some more kind of like echoes of religious conditioning that somehow tells us it's more noble if we're really pretty intense here and pretty serious. And a friend of mine, you know, in remarking upon this, one of my colleagues, he says sometimes when he looks at people on retreats in the West and doing walking meditation, it's kind of like the March of the Condemned. You know? But I think, you know, joy is spoken of so widely in this teaching and path, not as a kind of optional extra. But it's something very, very central to the very fabric of awakening and understanding. So I want to speak about this both in the wider sense and in the very specific sense of altruistic joy. I think this Brahmavihara of mudita is probably spoken about much less than the other qualities of metta and compassion and even of equanimity. And yet that does not mean that joy or mudita occupies a more lowly place. It occupies a very equal place. It is, I feel, joy that brings qualities of kindness and serenity to equanimity. And joy is something that teaches us, our hearts, to appreciate and to celebrate, to very much in a way almost the roots of generosity and responsiveness. And joy is very deeply important as a companion to compassion. Because we see in that opening to the degrees of suffering and torment that can exist in our wider world and indeed within our own inner world, joy almost guards the heart from being overwhelmed by the vastness and of pain and suffering that it encounters. In a way, joy almost replenishes, it almost restores and strengthens that capacity to open. And it guards compassion from the more selective perceptions, where we are prone to perceive only that which is broken and imperfect. And in a very real sense, joy teaches us to remember what is well and what is lovely. Altruistic joy, as I mentioned, the primary direction of the third of the Brahmaviharas, but the capacity to it's the capacity to celebrate and to appreciate the goodness and the lovely in others and in ourselves. But in this wider sense, joy is one of the common threads that runs through the fabric of all of the wholesome qualities that we're encouraged to cultivate in this path. So joy, certainly in Buddhist teaching, is considered to be an indispensable wholesome balancing quality of consciousness. And I think it's very important to reflect on how much it is present in our own path, how much we actually mark or have any dedication to cultivating joy. Because it's not as if we can try to be joyful. But we need to learn how to make room for joy, how to make space for joy. And in that sense, you know, part of mindfulness, part of sati, is remembering to do so and to remember that it is possible to do so. Why is it so important? Well, mindfulness and compassion have particular kind of invitations. They ask us to open to and to meet the whole of our lives. And when we turn to meet the difficult, the afflicted in ourselves, the painful, the suffering, inwardly and outwardly, when there is an absence of joy, the mind can become very raw. And I can't even think of a better word for that. It's raw. It's almost like imbalance. It's almost like an overexposure. It's almost like a over-sensitivity. And it can magnify, actually it can magnify the difficult, even to the point where it seems overwhelming. And I would encourage you to think of that in your own experience, in your own meditative practice. If you have something quite difficult going on in your life, or in a very difficult emotional state, a very difficult physical state, you know, you can sense how, you know, often the kind of encouragement of mindfulness is to open to this, to stay with this. And yet, when we are only exposed to the painful and the difficult, without the balancing of factor of joy, it can almost feel as if that difficulty becomes heightened, becomes more intense, becomes more magnified, to the sense that it can feel, oh no, it's too much. It's just too much to stay with this. And those are the places, actually, that I think that are telling us something quite important. They're telling us that somehow mindfulness doesn't have all of its companions in place. You know, and one of the kind of family of mindfulness, of course, there are many, many members of the family of mindfulness: investigation, equanimity, concentration. But one of the important family members of mindfulness is joy. And when, in the absence of joy, the exposure, or even overexposure to the difficult, can seem to create a kind of contractedness, where actually that is all that is being perceived in the moment. You know, this thought pattern in my mind, this life issue that is arising. Then this is quite important to get a felt sense of for ourselves, because that invitation to turn towards the whole of our life with mindfulness, in which actually the difficult can seem to be even highlighted, it sometimes gets matched up with what I see to be a kind of inner proclivity, inner inclination in many people's minds, which is actually to have a bias to seeing what is wrong. To have a kind of proclivity of mind, an inclination actually to primarily focus on what is imperfect. I mean, we certainly, you know, if we listen in our culture, we do see this a lot, don't we? You know, the tendency to see what is broken, the tendency to see what is wrong. Now, joy, of course, is never a denial of the difficult. But the understanding that our capacity to see in an encompassing way is actually strengthened and made more serene and more malleable and more responsive by the presence of joy. It allows us, I think, in many ways, to hold in our hands the reality that all of our lives and many of our moments are formed of both the lovely and the unlovely, the welcome and the unwelcome. And I think it is a change of perception, understanding that the presence of the unlovely does not deny the existence of the lovely. It is the way that we are perceiving that actually denies the existence of the lovely. Think of it as you sit here right now. You know, maybe your knee hurts, you know? Maybe you've got something pressing going on at home. And you sit in meditation, or you just sit here right now. How evenly distributed is the weight of your mindfulness between that sensation of your knee or that nagging preoccupation and the awareness of the sun coming through the window? Or do we see that we tend to move towards, to contract around, the difficult and the imperfect? I think there's a very real question there. Is that a conducive climate in which the difficulty is understood? So mindfulness is much more than this capacity to focus on what is. It is also being very much aware of the very quality of our mindfulness, the very quality of how we are attending, the kind of climate of the mind, which is made up of many, many different factors in any single moment. But notice when there is attention or focus, without the bigger family of mindfulness that includes joy, often attention turns into a kind of preoccupation or dwelling in itself. Starts out with good intention and turns into this much more contracted space. So to pause for a minute, does anybody have any questions about that or objections to that? I'm quite happy if you have objections to it, by the way. No? Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not sure about how to actually achieve that without it being forced.
We'll get into that a little bit. As I mentioned, I'm not quite sure joy can be born of a result of forcing.
No, I don't think so. I can see the value in acting as though you're generous, or even when you maybe don't feel it, but to create that in yourself. But I don't see how you can do that with joy.
No, I don't believe you can. I think the capacity for, we will go into it more, but I think it's more about how we learn to make room for joy rather than trying to pretend we're joyful. We're not going to pull this one off.
I think that you said before to incline the mind, and I have found that if I look for things that I can share so much joy, or if I say I'm happy for you, that again reinforces.
It is part of the inclining, and I think joy is much as metta, much of compassion is part of this fabric of actually learning to incline the mind. But again, we see how much that rests upon mindfulness, because it's remembering. And I think it becomes very evident in our experience that the very nature of contractedness, the very nature of preoccupation, the very nature of obsession is to create a kind of amnesia. If we are very contracted in a difficult mental state or a difficult life situation, it is almost as if there's pretty much a full forgetfulness that we ever felt anything other than this in our entire lives. Or that there's even a possibility. The mental state becomes so predominant, and particularly difficult mental states, that the kind of very remembering of joy is sort of leached out of that moment. Yes.
I was thinking about this making room for joy, and you dragged me into this, but my experience is because I have a deeply rooted habit pattern of finding what is wrong, that matches what the media does, that I have to, in my own experience, make room sometimes by not consuming more of the same.
Yeah. I mean, I think in psychological theory, it's a pretty well recognized fact that, probably hardwired into us from when we needed to be always alert to signs of danger, that the human mind does have the proclivity to isolate what is wrong, to be on a hyper alert to what is imperfect and broken. And, it is a tendency that arises in the moment, and it is a tendency that is fed in various ways. And we need to be so mindful of where we are feeding that tendency in ways that are unhelpful and unskillful. Not that it's bad or wrong, but that recognizing that it's very survival and, of course, its growth relies upon that feeding process. Okay, so we'll go on a little bit. So mudita has its roots in the Pali term to gladden. To gladden, to liberate the heart through gladness. Now, when the Buddha speaks about gladness, I think he's not speaking about, you know, because often when we think about joy, we think about intensity. I don't think the Buddha is actually speaking about states of exhilaration or excitement or rapture, although they can have traces very clearly of gladness and joy within them. What is most crucial when the Buddha speaks about joy, he speaks about inwardly generated joy. This is the very crucial part. Inwardly generated joy, born, very much born of our own hearts and minds, understanding and ease. This is the absolute critical part. So much of the path, as we know it, is really dedicating to learning to know the source of true happiness and joy within our own minds, and not just in the world of conditions. This is a kind of critical piece of the Buddha's teaching, is to be ungoverned by conditions and to find inwardly generated joy. So it's perhaps important when we look at this inwardly generated gladness, inwardly generated joy, to look at the ways in which we learn to cultivate and to connect with this quality before we look specifically at altruistic joy. It's almost as if we need to learn the lessons of joy. It's almost like we're reteaching ourselves the lessons of joy. What it is to develop a heart that can be gladdened. Is to develop a heart that can actually be delighted. In the Dhammapada, there's a piece where the Buddha speaks of joy, and he says, "Live in joy, in love, even amongst those who hate. Live in joy, in health, even among the afflictions. Live in joy, in peace, even amongst the troubled. Look within, be still, free from fear and attachment. Know the sweet joy of the way." He also goes on, as I mentioned yesterday, again very specifically, saying it's a disciplined heart that knows true joy. Again, putting joy into the context of a very consciously cultivated path, rather than an experience that we stumble across if we're lucky. So the first aspect, I think, of joy that is spoken of in the text is the aspect of sensual joy. It might surprise you. You know, this is a renunciate tradition. There's a lot of asceticism in this tradition. You know, renunciation is often mistaken with asceticism. Doesn't seem, you know, really quite appropriate to speak of sensual joy within a renunciate tradition. It's difficult, isn't it, when you're not ordained, when you're a lay person living in the world, and you might carry around with you the impression that sensual joy is a bit of a Buddhist error. You know, to pull that one back. But it is part of our life, sensual joy. Life would be a very much poorer place without wonderful music and art and literature. we delight in many things sensually in this life. The laugh of a child, sunset, the trees. We go outside and we appreciate so much the beauty of the natural world. Now, there's a real difference here, isn't there, between sensual appreciation and sensual craving. This is a distinction we're all asked to make in our lives. They have a very different tone within the mind. I'm sure you can feel that. Sensual craving is very much that kind of rooted in insufficiency. It's very much a pursuit. It's very much a sense of need, rooted in a sense of lack. It has a kind of desperateness to it. You know, I just need to have more sensual pleasures. Sensual joy, I think, or sensual appreciation is very different. All of the moments of loveliness in our life can be surrounded by clinging. They are not intrinsically sources of clinging. The sources of clinging do not lie in the silhouette of the tree in the sky. The sources of clinging very much lie in our own sense of sufficiency or insufficiency. Our path is not made more noble by an uninterrupted preoccupation with dukkha. You know, opening our eyes and opening our hearts in moments of natural loveliness, I think we learn some very important lessons about stillness and receptivity, about calming the agitation. We get a taste of joy. There is something here about learning to use our sense doors wisely. Because what we see in our sense doors, and our eyes, our ears, our tongues, the way that our sense doors are used in every moment in our life is kind of a messenger of the mind, isn't it? That our sense doors can be used as a kind of vehicle for embodying greed, and we can be beggars at the sense door, you know, simply trying to consume the world when there is a sense of lack. But our sense doors can also be vehicles of a tremendous receptivity and stillness and appreciation, learning how to pause and teaching and almost deepening our capacity for that stillness and receptivity. It has nothing to do with greed. It has nothing to do with wanting or consuming. It has something to do with teaching ourselves the lessons of being wholeheartedly present. And in many ways, this is part of making room for joy. We need to be there. We need to be there. And as part of an insight practice, you know, really being mindful of how our eyes, how our ears, how our bodies are being used moment to moment in life in relation to the world of sensory objects has huge pieces of learning and understanding that is offered to us about the kind of suffering and the contractedness of craving and wanting and the ease and the freedom in the cessation of craving and wanting. In a way, you know, this kind of mindfulness at the sense doors is learning to liberate the world. It's not just learning to liberate our own minds and hearts. I think it is learning to liberate the world from being seen as simply something that exists in order to satisfy our craving. Think about this not only in relationship to the world of sensual objects, but to the world of people and relationships. Wouldn't it be a terrible thing to go into a relationship with a mind that says, I need you to make me happy? Is that embarrassing? Yeah, I need you to make me happy. So I think there is something here about in the presence of the lovely, in the presence of sensual pleasure, to learn that it is indeed possible to be wholeheartedly there without craving. Then there's some room for something else. Then there may actually be room for joy. Before I move on from this piece to another dimension, does anybody have any questions about sensual pleasure? Yeah. I mean, craving, it is, I think the Buddha was quite correct in spotting it as being kind of one of the major causes of suffering. It has no conscience. We need to recognize that. And, you know, the little ones are as important as the big ones. But the approach to understanding craving is also so critical. Because I think, you know, we can do ourselves a grave wound by actually being very judgmental about craving. We need to be curious about craving. But we also need to have at times some quality of resolve that is rooted in understanding. I mean, how many times do we need to go in our life and experience the ripples of difficulty, you know, after being lost in craving, to realize it's never going to have a different outcome? You know, it's not going to have a different outcome. I think that's a very important place from which, you know, a certain level of restraint and resolve actually arises. But, you know, I remember one of my early teachers saying to me that to let go of craving is one of the greatest acts of compassion that we offer to ourselves. I think the whole investigation of craving, the restraint, the investigation, all needs to be kind of rooted in that quality of compassion and care. But sometimes resolve is compassion. You know, and sometimes restraint is compassion. It's not always just nice, soft, you know, feeling. It's a big habit pattern. It's one of the big three. It's not a small thing to understand. But again, I would just say again, it's present moment focus. We don't understand tomorrow's cravings, and we don't do anything about yesterday's cravings. We only do what's present. Yeah, I'm sure that's true, because it becomes very defensive. And yeah, that's also not very successful. It's kind of, you know, it's interesting, we do have to learn these lessons for ourselves, and actually when you read sort of the history of the Buddha's teaching, you see people having to learn these lessons for centuries. You know, that in many times in ancient, you know, Asian cultures, craving was run from by, say, mortifying the body. You know, through extreme ascetic practices. Again, didn't quite work. You know, but we can't learn from somebody else's lessons. We actually really do need to learn it ourselves. We also have to just acknowledge that craving is normalized in our culture as being something quite kind of one of the standards of a successful life. Is that you're able to satisfy your cravings. So, you know, there's quite a big social fabric around craving. But it is not the same as joy, and we know that. We know very distinctly the different felt sense of being able to satisfy a craving, which is very, you know, slightly temporary, and a genuinely, inwardly generated joy. We know the difference in feeling tone of those. Yeah.
When you speak of joy, it makes me think of how I kind of protect exposing my joy sometimes because of the reaction. Sometimes I feel like people are jealous of joy. And I don't know that
Yeah, I would be careful with that. I mean, I actually think there's, you know, quite a shortage of joy in our life. I mean, I love to be around joyful folks. You know, if someone's jealous, I'm afraid I can't really take care of that. But, you know, there's something, isn't there, around being around joy, which just gladdens our own hearts. I mean, it can also be part of mudita to celebrate the joy of another. To go on a little bit in some of the dimensions of joy that's spoken of in the Buddha's teaching. So first there is a dimension of sensual joy. The second dimension of joy that the Buddha describes is really the outcome of a life that's permeated by and guided by ethics and integrity. Buddha speaks of it as the joy of blamelessness. Sometimes even the bliss of blamelessness. Of a life where integrity or ethics really permeates and guides our thoughts, our words, our actions, our choices. I think coming back to metta, I think what we see that when our hearts are actually truly, genuinely not in the grip of aversion, unethical acts don't arise. It's like without aversion, there is no ground for unethical acts of harm. So with metta, we actually are cultivating an environment which becomes a ground not only of ethics, but then in which the seeds of joy can be planted and thrive. When the Buddha speaks about ethics or integrity as being the bliss of blamelessness, he also speaks about it as a way of life that frees the mind from residues. The residues of guilt, of shame, and the very big phrase, if only. If only I hadn't said that, if only I hadn't done that, you know, if only I'd acted differently, and all the narratives and the stories that are spun around the moments when we somehow feel that we have disrespected our own kind of sense of values. You know, and much of the residues is not only about, you know, the effect harmful words or speech may have had on others. It's more to do with the sense of somehow departing inwardly from what we most cherish and most value. Ethics as an expression of metta, fostering relationships of respect, of honesty and fearlessness outwardly and inwardly, I would probably consider, I mean, I think the Buddha would say, said this, it's a necessary foundation of mudita and of all joy. That joy is not possible without an ethical foundation. I want to spend time with each of these. So does anybody have any questions about this aspect of the bliss of blamelessness or the relationship between joy and ethics?
Joy is just waiting to come in?
Well, it's one of the great possibilities of the human heart and the human mind, but the conditions are there, need to be there for that joy, for joy to arise. And ethics are part of that fabric of conditions. Yeah.
What comes up for me is just the experience of having a cleaned up relationship when the honesty and care is really there, that feeling of joy that comes. It seems like that's connected to this, the ethics that
yeah.
just, you know, that it's just there aren't those barriers.
It's very, very true. I mean, bearing in mind what we talked about yesterday, how much metta is very much interwoven with ethics. And as the Buddha speaks about metta and ethics, he basically says it's a ground of fearlessness. That you don't need to, nobody needs to fear you. Nobody needs to fear you. And you have sufficient ground of stability inwardly that you don't need to fear others. Then there's more space for joy.
The idea of joy seems different than what you're presenting, the way. I'm thinking of joy as sort of what happens when you get what you want, but you're referring to it more like somehow related to understanding or depth.
Absolutely. I'm really only speaking about inwardly generated joy. The joy of getting what we want is the very poor cousin of inwardly generated joy. You know, we do get what we want sometimes in life. You know, it's not like we never get what we want. We do get what we want sometimes. And, you know, there are momentary feelings of happiness that arise from that. There's nothing wrong with that.
But they're
not the same. They're not. They are intimations. I will call them intimations. You know, if you really want something and you feel that moment, you know, of, you know, happiness, it's not the same as joy, but it is an intimation of the heart's capacity to experience an inwardly generated joy. So it's kind of like a messenger. Yes, the heart can actually be happy. You know, the mind actually can be happy. But the great, of course, error that can be made is to think that that happiness just relies upon continually getting what I want, which is only going to get us into trouble. And what the Buddha said, you know, he said, don't dismiss those intimations of happiness. Build on them. But with wisdom. So instead of turning outwardly in an endless pursuit of life, of things, of experience, of people, turn inwardly and actually see whether there is a quality of inwardly generated happiness and joy that is far different. Now, go into this a little bit more for you. They're intimations. They're not bad, not wrong, but they're intimations of something far deeper. And yeah.
On the ethical relation of ethics and joy, in some ways I could see that ethics, you could always fall short of your own ethical standards. Well, maybe I'm just talking about myself, but in that respect, it doesn't necessarily bring joy because you feel like you could do more, like maybe in charity, clearly there's a line you draw,
yeah.
And then you wonder about that line if it's drawn a little bit too, and you might question, and that might be an antipathy towards joy, that ethical kind of attitude. Am I making myself clear there?
Well, you are, but I think I would have a question about it, because I think, you know, ethics is really talking about what's going on in our mind and our understanding. The actions that come from that are quite, you know, the secondary piece. But, you know, certainly in Buddhist teaching, you would always be turning back, what is the mind? You know, what is the world of experience? So you would be looking, okay, you know, does that kind of line, is it born of fear or is it born simply of practicalities? You know, in which case there's no ethical, it's ethically neutral. It's ethically neutral. You know, if I say that my line of generosity is always drawn by fear, you know, and you know, sense of deficit, then that would be an arena of investigation. But it wouldn't necessarily in itself be ethically incorrect.
Right. Easier said than done for me, actually. I can see what you're saying, that investigation. But there's still, I don't know, I feel, as far as ethics are concerned, there's always more that could be done.
As far as ethics is concerned, there's always more that can be understood. I mean, a friend of mine said something which I so much appreciate. He said that if practicing the precepts in an ethical life does not make you uncomfortable, you haven't understood it. Because it's not just about having certain rules or certain guidelines or easy answers. Simply because of what I said before, that it always involves this quality of what's actually going on here? You know? What is shaping my thoughts? What is shaping my words? What is shaping my actions? So it's not that there's ever a place where there's the evidence and the proof that, okay, that was ethically right and that was ethically wrong. You know, much of our lives is lived in that gray area of a question of what is actually motivating this action? What is actually motivating this non-action? But it's not about reaching a place of certainty where we always have this kind of evidence that says, oh yes, that was ethically sound. You know, and I think, you know, that is often, you know, in other situations, too much the invitation towards a kind of fundamentalism. You know, that says, here's the evidence of ethical soundness and that doesn't fit the bill. You know, and I don't think the sort of Buddhist teaching was in any way concerned with that kind of evidence-based structure in terms of ethics. In some ways that works very well in terms of process, etc. But in terms of ethics, I think that the investigation factor is that.
So the ethical grayness that your friend might have talked about and joy.
They are not exclusive. In fact, there can actually be a great joy in feeling that we have the freedom to ask the questions, you know, and the interest in asking the questions, rather than, you know, the certainty of the right answers. Now, the next piece of joy that I want to speak about is another. I mean, there's all these different dimensions of joy. I just want to make that clear. This is not a kind of one linear, one dimensional emotion. Now, a lot of the ways that you will see joy spoken about in the discourses, particularly, are the very joyful and blissful states associated with deep concentration absorptions. And again, you know, this is simple, it's actually a simple reality that if the attention and the meditative training is directed towards cultivating very deep concentration states, there are profound experiences of rapture, of bliss, of joy. I would also say these are not necessarily confined to people who are doing year-long retreats or anything else. Sometimes people are quite surprised in bumping into some of these deep states of absorption that generate inwardly so much joy, rapture, bliss. Now, again, the Buddha was very, very careful in approaching, you know, this whole domain of meditative experience. And concentration states are certainly one aspect of meditative experience. He was very clear, and I think I've certainly in my experience is very clear, that these concentration states that can be experienced, they have limits. They're not liberating in themselves. They have yet they have boundaries. They are experiences. They're states. You enter them, you leave them. They have beginnings, they have endings. So the Buddha very much cautioned against pursuing these states as ends in themselves. But it was very clear, if any of you have any acquaintance at all with Buddhist teaching, you will see that this whole emphasis and valuing of developing concentration states is both a pre-Bodhi tree and a post-Bodhi tree valuing of the Buddha. It was meditative trainings that he engaged in before his own awakening, and it's actually very hard to read any discourse on meditative development where the Buddha is not encouraging, he is always encouraging people to develop some level, actually some often very deeply refined level of collectedness and focus and concentration. So it's very clear in saying these are not ends in themselves. They're not paths to liberation, but it does not make them unworthy. Because what is actually worthy in these concentration developments is that they offer us a glimpse of the vast potential of our mind and our heart to know an inwardly generated joy. Because it's not coming from anywhere else. And you have just a glimpse of actually the remarkable potential of our minds and hearts to know that kind of unbounded quality of joy. It's born of a mind and a heart that's freed from fragmentation, free from distractedness, free from dispersal, freed at least momentarily from the hindrances. It's a mind, it's a kind of mind in which you discover this is really a friend. But also what the Buddha said about these concentration states, that they are valuable if the insight that they offer is really understood. Because if one can experience, for example, in very deep meditative states, some of that inwardly generated joy, the implication is that it completely shifts and alters one's relationship to the world outside of these states, because quite frankly, craving doesn't make any sense anymore. You know, and clinging doesn't make any sense anymore. Because to actually have a taste of that inwardly generated joy, there's such a knowing, such a deep knowing, that there's actually nothing that you're going to get through craving, through clinging, through identification, that is going to offer any element of happiness that's going to compare, even in the slightest, to that inwardly generated joy. So actually, craving just starts to look a bit tacky. It just looks a bit like why? When actually it's only offering is this kind of little moments, when actually inwardly there is this wealth of potential of discovering such profound levels of inner joy, inner happiness, inner sufficiency, that the entire relationship to the world, it has much to do in as joy in terms of uprooting the tendency towards greed, towards blowing out the fires of greed. So I'm not encouraging people to go out and do, you know, long concentration retreats, but to appreciate that the value of this dimension of meditative development, part of the value of it, not only is developing a mind that doesn't like to do even proliferation anymore, but developing a heart that really just becomes disenchanted with craving and greed, because it's simply because there's no kind of arguing or dispute with the reality of inwardly generated happiness born of a mind, a well-trained mind, a well-disciplined heart and mind that opens that door to inner happiness and joy. Anybody have any questions about that? Yeah.
I'm just curious if you would encourage long concentration retreats if the intention is to use concentration as a vehicle for insight.
Absolutely. I mean, the Buddha only ever talked about the value of concentration as being a vehicle for insight. you know, I've seen and, you know, plenty of times when people are doing concentration retreats and they just turn into actually a more refined level of dukkha. Because, you know, am I in first jhana? Am I in second jhana? How do I get third jhana? Oh no, I lost it, you know. And it just becomes a much more refined domain of craving and dukkha. But I've also seen many more people who, with the kind of right intention and wise intention, developing concentration in a way in which it's entirely dedicated to deepening insight and certainly to uprooting some of the greed, call it tendency, you know, which hasn't actually really glimpsed that kind of inner joy, and who's actually using it, and it's how the Buddha talks about concentration in the scriptures, is you develop this capacity, you know, develop the collectedness, then turn that concentration to contemplate, you know, the three characteristics, to really understand the implications of peace, of happiness, of joy, all of which are inwardly generated in concentration states. So there's always the encouragement. And certainly, you know, if one has time in one's meditative life, I never feel that it's a waste of time. But it's a kind of singularity of intention, you know. And I see, you know, like within the Buddhist tradition, there's so many different meditative pathways. You know, I mean, many of them are doorways to awakening. You know, when the Buddha speaks about the doorways to awakening, he speaks about many. He speaks about the Brahma Viharas, you know, speaks about various styles of insight practices, various cultivations of reflections, contemplations of emptiness, of non-self, speaks about these various ways. And the thing is that we sometimes underestimate what a training all of these different pathways are. You know, and I think sometimes we can be prone to go for breadth at times too much, rather than spending a sustained period of time developing one of these pathways. And I'm not only talking about on intensive retreat. You know, I see people very much in daily life practice say, you know, I'm going to give a year to simply working with the Brahma Viharas, or even one of them. Or I'm going to give a year simply working with concentration practice. You don't sacrifice insight in any of these practices. But there's a kind of singularity of intention that allows the actual meditative training to develop. You don't lose, you know, if you spend a year developing metta, for example, you gain concentration, you learn to incline the mind. Most of us don't develop metta without plenty of insight into aversion. You know, so it's not if there's a lot, you know, it's not as if you're just taking a sliver of the pie and the whole of the rest of the pie is being forgotten. But what you are developing is a singularity of intentionality, which is so central to actually deepening in any particular pathway of meditative development. Because they're all trainings. Yeah.
I've had the experience on the retreat of being in a zone, you know, where you're in touch with something that's bigger than yourself, or on a basketball court, or taking an exam, or talking to somebody. You can get in a zone. What I find difficult is taking those zones and having them at other times. I never know when they're going to happen. They're sort of spontaneous events. How do you take it out? How do you take it out into the world?
I mean, I think, you know, the pathways talked about in what I'm talking about this weekend is actually moving out of spontaneous events into the kind of moments that we stumble upon that might have the characteristics of metta or the characteristics of joy. I think it's very important that we do have those moments, because they actually wake us up quite profoundly and think, oh, there's another way of being in this life, you know? Not that we're maybe not the sort of always the contracted, preoccupied people that we think ourselves to be. And so we stumble across these moments, and they raise very important questions. But certainly in the what I'm talking about this weekend, and I owe a debt of gratitude certainly to the Buddhist teaching for this, he says spontaneous moments are not enough. We need to train the heart. We need to train the mind. We need to have that discipline of cultivation. And if we do cultivate, you know, this becomes the abiding of the mind, not a moment that we stumble across. Sorry, I wish there was a shortcut.
No, I'm just saying that those moments are a window into what's
possible. They are indeed a window, and they're very important in that sense. And they can become then the basis for, you know, a very heartfelt dedication to actually, how do I train this? How do I develop this? You know, how do I cultivate this? And to the point where it becomes the vihara, you know, the monastery where my mind and heart is living. But they are very important windows.
I've had those or experienced those states. You know, there's such, for me, there's such an acute mindfulness. And, but what happens is they come to an end, and then I experience what I think of as mindlessness, you know, where, you know, I just totally lose it.
You mean these concentration states?
Yeah.
Yes, but it doesn't have to be that way. That may be your experience so far, but I would not expect... I think sometimes the reason why people sometimes have... it's a very delicate area, some of these meditative experiences that come along in people's lives. Because often they are followed by a sense of disappointment or a crash in their ending. But I think there's other elements that are coming into play there of wanting something to stay or feeling a sense of loss, you know, rather than this was a state. It comes and it goes. What have I learned? You know, what have I learned from it? I also just want to say that, you know, it's very delicate when we talk about some of these states that can be developed through meditative training, because some people have a kind of mind and a sort of temperament that seems to be very inclined towards an easier development of some of these kind of these states and meditative experiences. It's very important not to highlight them too much, because other people have a temperament and a kind of mind that doesn't seem to. And it doesn't mean their practice is less, or their effort is less, or their sincerity is less. It just seems to be temperamentally different in the practice. Certainly doesn't mean their insight is less. But what I would say, that for everyone, whether they experience these, you know, kind of headline meditative experiences or not, every single one of us in this room has the capacity to develop such a well-trained mind and heart that actually touches upon inwardly generated joy and happiness. And it doesn't mean, you know, retreating to a monastery. It doesn't mean, it doesn't hinge upon having certain meditative experiences, but it does hinge upon this level of commitment and training. And I know I sound like a broken record here, but, you know, in my experience, meditative deepening does not happen without this kind of discipline and training and dedication, born of love and born of care, not born of ambition, not born of shoulds, but actually because we really want to live with a mind that feels like a friend. Because we really want to not live with a mind that feels like, you know, we wake up in the morning with dread about what our mind is going to do today. That actually we know, this is a mind that works well. This is a heart that works well. Not only in terms of a clarity, but in terms of kindness, in terms of balance. But it's like the other side. You know, sometimes we love the idea of that more than we love the work of it. And yet, the work of it is central.
I'm glad you're talking about this, though. Because once in a while, I will get some kind of a deeply concentrated state, following my breath, and then all of a sudden it just feels so, all the little tiny, minute parts of the breath just are huge, and they get hips unraveling. And I can be really curious about that, but then I'll get to a point where it's scary.
Yeah.
And then the curiosity gets replaced by, what's my head doing up there?
It's quite normal to feel that kind of fear. There's all kinds of weird stuff that happens in meditation. You're sitting and it feels like your head's on top of your knee or something, and your ear moved down to your toe, and it's kind of like, oh gosh, I'm not sure that I'm breathing anymore. It's all kinds of weird and wonderful stuff that happens when the mind starts to lose its concreteness through only a very particular way of perception. And perception, and being lost in the world of perception is keeping things fixed in place. When through the mind becoming more collected, more gathered, there's all kinds of very unusual perceptual shifts that happen. Sometimes there's a feeling of, not knowing quite what's real and what's not real anymore, who I am. And I think that the first responses to that are quite understandably a sense of anxiety, a sense of fear. This is unfamiliar territory. Yep.
But it has a boundary, and then once it goes past that boundary, it's like, okay.
That changes. I can only say that changes. Because, and I think when that kind of anxiety sort of arises often in the face of familiarity in every aspect of our life, it's very wise to respect it. It's often very wise to kind of step back a little and make life a little bit more concrete and familiar again for a time. But you do find that, that actually when you're not so kind of anxious about things staying in place, the fear element just starts to fade away with practice. It does change, but you don't ever force it.